You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hey, everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. We got Mark Maddox back with us again. Yes, we threatened that he would be back, and he is with us. Mark is back with us for like an incredible tour de force monster movie.
I remember everything else.
When I got a hold of a copy of this, I had not seen it in many, many years, and called him immediately and said, we've got to do this movie. Of course, you know, we're talking about The Boy Who Cried Werewolf, 1973. We have talked about a lot of werewolf movies along the, you know, during the history of Monster Attack, but we've never touched this one before. So,
well,
you could take that any way you want.
So I'm glad to hear, you know, that Jim is, you know, ever since that anvil fell out of that window from the Acme company and hit him in the head,
yeah,
that he is actually controlling once again his ability to say wolf.
I really struggle with that.
I gotta say this one time for the world, anytime you ever see Jim, anytime you're ever, even you're going out, so even just talking to Jim, I want this to become a new thing. Woof. Woof. Look, mama, it's a baby wolf. And with Jim Adams, look, mama, it's a baby werewolf. So I don't know, man. It's like weird.
As a kid and stuff, I never had problems with it. But it was just like, I don't know. After I turned 50, I think it was right around there, I was all would find myself stumbling over that. And it didn't really become apparent until we started doing Monster Attack. And then, of course, then it became very, you know, that I was really, really struggling with it. Especially considering our third episode was The Werewolf.
Yeah.
And that's where it really showed up. It's like, I think we had to stop and start.
Probably because we were laughing.
Yeah, that was part of it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. But if you, I swear, like when I reached like the age of 40 or something like that, I was like, certain words that you use every day, and I can't remember them off the top of my head, all of a sudden it's like they're like a tongue twister. I mean, just a general word.
That's true.
And it's weird. So I then go home to my then wife and go, I think I had a stroke or something. She goes, don't say that. And that was the end of the conversation. But right. Every once in a while you run into a word that you've said your whole life.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden really it's weird. Difficult. I don't know. So we're talking about this masterpiece, to hell with The Exorcist, to hell with Jaws, to hell with The Bride of Frankenstein. Nothing on this planet is better than The Boy Who Cried Werewolf. Nothing.
Now, welcome to this week's edition of Monster Attack, Point Counterpoint.
This is
Mark's coming in from that point of view. You know, I'm coming in from the other side.
No, this is called sarcasm.
Yes.
This is the special sarcastic episode. It's in one of those weird places where you're just getting ready to get hit over the head, unless you already have. Maybe this was already in production. Well, you're getting ready to get hit in the head with The Exorcist.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. You look at this movie and you go, this is the death knell of the old PG rated monster movie. This and a few others time period. And we brought up Night of the Lepus.
Yep.
I mean, good or bad, whether you like them or not. I know people that hate Night of the Lepus. I know people that love Night of the Lepus. I mean, I like it a lot.
I think it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, man.
We'll do a show on that one. But it's one of those where there's other than about a 5 or 10 minute boring spot and close to the end. I thought that the movie was still pretty good for such a weird, weird concept. But then, you know, you mentioned a movie earlier.
We will definitely do a show on that.
But that came out. I mean, you said you saw it on a thing for it on a double bill. I saw both of those films separately, but around the same year.
Right. Well, they came out as a double bill. I mean, originally when they were released on a double bill. when this, and in fact, one of the reasons I wanted to do this movie was because it was actually, its national release was on my birthday.
Oh, okay.
So in November of 1960, November Jim. Of 1973. So I thought, oh, well, that's a sign from God that we need to do
it's
this.
It's all movie. About you, Jim.
But at that time, now I didn't see it on the original release. I saw it later on, a year later, in one of the small theaters in Chapel Hill. And and then I saw, I'm trying to think, I guess, or you would call Sis or whatever.
Well, they made them
which I think
they
is a very good movie. I think I saw that in a small theater too before it made the TV run for quite a
while. No, it was on CBS Late Movie later. Yeah, it was one of those where it, I remember going to the theater and thinking, you know, we were getting movies like Frogs and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But this was like one of the first times, or maybe the first time, where a sound effect was the title of the film.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was so
bizarre. And I hated it because later they dumbed it down and changed it to Snake.
Yeah, they didn't need
to. And they went, and they now everybody's gone back to. It was where it was fun to stand there and ask for that. You know, ask for your movie ticket to see the film. I'd like a ticket to see. Well, technically, that's true. I didn't have to because my theater only ran one film at a time. They didn't have a multiplex. It was a base theater. But so you had movies like that. You had these PG rated. They were almost like one notch above what Universal was doing on television. I mean, and even in today's film, the film we're talking about today, there was things about it that you just roll your eyes for a movie, as opposed to like all the day for night shots. Oh my God, just kidding.
Oh, they had just some real problems with consistency on that.
It didn't even matter. It was just like, it looked, I was expecting Steve Austin to be fighting Bigfoot on the land that they were doing. You know what I mean? It was that same, on the $6 million man, you got it.
It was in the Northwest, Northwestern part of California, where, probably like the Big Sur area or something, where they used to shoot a lot of monster movies up there.
Well, in that case, and even with some of the scenarios in this movie, it almost, I was like, this is almost like a sequel to The Werewolf. I mean,
it reminded me so much of that. Yeah. I mean, as far as the location.
The countryside, the lakes, the pine trees, all that stuff. But the day for night in this movie is so much. It's like, oh, man. And then, you know, the next year we're watching The Night Stalker on television. Yeah. And The Night Stalker shot night for night. I mean, that was one thing about that show that was impressive. But you know, I'm watching this and I'm like, you know, the dad's fighting with the werewolf. And all of a sudden you see some bright blue sky breaking through the trees. And then when they finally have to get to the part where, oh my God, he's turning back because the sun's coming out or whatever. And then it's like the lighting barely changed. But okay, so we're talking about this movie from
1973.
And we've got a cast in it how am I going to put this? Well, I'm just going to jump in with both feet. This isn't the best movie ever made. It's there's worse, but this one has got a lot of things for it that
it's made. It comes across as a made for TV film to me.
Well, no,
when I saw it the first time in the theater, it's like, this should have been one of the ABC movies of the week or something.
But you know what? I wouldn't be surprised if it was almost like, well, what do we do with it? You know?
Yeah.
I could be wrong, but when you look at it, I mean, you look at movies like, there was a couple of werewolf films on television at the time, Moon of the Wolf and were, I mean, I'm not saying they were masterpieces either, but they were better.
Actually, that one's pretty good. We've got that one on our list too, as well.
Yeah, and then I'm going to go over go back and forth between the strengths and weaknesses of this movie. Mm-hmm. One is that it's a pretty good cast, but it's misused, and I don't think that many people get to do any kind of performances in this movie.
No,
we've got Kerwin Matthews, who we love, tremendously from Sinbad and his work in Hammer films and stuff like that. He was
and he's part of a team with Nathan Jurin, who is the director of all of the Sinbad, you know, the Sinbad films and stuff. So these two are familiar with one another. They work together with Kerwin Matthews actually took the role as a favor for one of the producers, and the same with Nathan Jurin. He directed the film. He came out of her. This is his last film. It's a shame it had to be his last film. But he'd been basically semi-retired and came out of retirement for this same producer to as a favor to him. So,
well, I'm going to say something here that's going to probably be unpopular with some people, but I've always felt this. There's always been a question I've thrown out. What's the best acted Ray Harryhausen film, or what are some of the best ones and what are some of the worst ones? And while Seventh Voyage of Sinbad is a classic for so many reasons, it's not because of the acting. I've always felt that the acting was a little bit like it was like for boys directed by boys, you know, very boy. It was boy. You know what I mean? It was very yo-ho and the evil magician and everything like that. Right, whereas one that I give very high marks to in terms of acting is Valley of the Guanji.
Oh God. Yes.
Where I felt that the acting was and the characters were as important as the monsters in the
film.
But you know, and like I said, I love Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, but I sort of look at the acting and go, okay, it's a product of its time. I mean, you can even say that a little bit about George Pal's War of the Worlds is very comic booky comparison to The Time Machine or When Worlds Collide. But in this film, you've got talented people that are kind of wasted. I feel bad for Kerwin Matthews. Like you said, if he did it as a favor and was already retired or quitting anyway, I guess it doesn't really matter. The two people that give me the best standout performances are the sheriff played by Robert Wilkie, who I love in all the old westerns.
Oh my God, he was one of the best villains ever. You know,
even when he's a good guy
growing up, but he did even when he's good guys now and then. Yeah,
well, even when he's a good guy, he's kind of rotten. But it adds real character. He had real character, real texture. And as far as I'm concerned, he gives about the best performance. Now the other one,
Can I guess who you're going to say? The other performances. Well, I'm going to say George Gaines.
I was going to say George Gaines.
Yep.
And it's because I never watched the shows that he was famous for. I mean, I saw him in Tootsie. He was very good in that.
Yes.
But I've never seen any of the shows that he got. I mean, something where he like adopted kids. I don't remember what it was, but
Punky Brewster. Well, he was big in Punky Brewster, but I'm trying to think. I remember him almost.
He was.
I think of him always from the Police Academy movies. I mean, that's.
Yeah. And know. See, I never really watched. I saw the first one and I liked it, but it
loved
was,
him in those.
It's been years. But it's tough. Sometimes it's like years ago when I was watching Failsafe at the movie theater over here at Florida State University. I'd seen it before, but I love the movie. And the movie is a very, very serious movie. And all of a sudden, Dom DeLuise is there giving him information. And the audience starts laughing because of Dom DeLuise's history. He was a great comedian and very funny, but this was a scene with him still acting like Dom DeLuise, but it was horrible what was going on.
Oh no,
he was
very good in that film. Yeah.
So Dom DeLuise, this is the same thing with this guy who has done so much comedy. It's almost like trying to get people to go back and watch Leslie Nielsen or something like that years later. I mean, his drama was really good, but then he had a second life in comedic roles, which he was excellent in. Same thing, this guy, I go back and I watch him as the therapist and I go, he's doing a pretty good job.
Yeah.
And then, but it's been so many years since I've seen this movie. I saw it in 73, maybe once on the CBS late movie. But when I remembered the light swinging back, I said, isn't there something in here with a light swinging back and forth and somebody laying there? And sure enough, it was him laying there dead.
Yeah.
One of the more effective scenes in the movie. And it was about that point that the movie went up a few notches with me.
But
those are the two standouts. I feel bad for Kerwin Matthews. He isn't bad in it, but he's not doing anything. Now, here's my question, Jim. I got the big question, and it does not involve the word woof. Do you know if Kerwin Matthews was in the werewolf makeup?
Yes.
It was him.
Yes, it was him.
Okay, because I'm going to say this. He was terrible as a werewolf.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't make a very good... Well, you know, a lot of the... This is where, when I mentioned made for TV, this film was filled with a lot of cliches. Now, somebody who may not have been alive during the early 70s might get a kick out of this because you really do get a look at how life was during the early 70s. We were pretty... crazy back then, the cars and the dresses, you know, the dress.
Yeah, because we're normal now. So,
yeah. But I mean, so it's a good nostalgia piece on that. But, back then when they made, I never could find the budget information on this film. I know it had to be relatively low, and it was probably the same as a TV movie budget.
I'd give it this is, I'm pretty good with budget stuff when you watch something. I would have given it a TV budget plus another half.
Yeah, that, you know, something I could see like that. But I mean, and usually the one thing that distinguished most of those, or not distinguished, maybe is the wrong word, it would separate the TV movies from the big movies that would actually make it out into, you know, into four walls, as we call it, you know, the big screen, is the acting. The acting would tend to be over the top, a little bit more scenery. And I saw a lot of that in this film.
Right.
And I hated it for Kerwin Matthews, because I think a lot of it was his character, and especially when he gets in the werewolf makeup, which is not bad. I mean, it's, you know, I'll give it that. The makeup is pretty good.
Tom Berman, is he the one who did the makeup?
Yeah, Tom Berman did the makeup. And again, he did a lot of TV work, you know, and I did read one critic who said, yeah, well, it sort of looked like the Shaggy DA. It was like, oh, come on, that's being a little harsh.
That's horseshit.
But I mean,
I'm gonna do a Colonel Parker. That's horse hockey.
Yeah, horse hockey. Okay. So, oh, that's no, okay. We've got the beeper.
The bleeper.
But I mean, fair. I think the makeup is fine. I had no problems with that at all.
Got no problem. I thought it was a little different. I think that they played off of the. I think they played off the fact that Kerwin Matthews had kind of salt and pepper hair, depending on what scene it was. Sometimes his hair was almost pure white, and then other times it was darker. I'm like, okay. But when you look at the changeover, it was the first. Was it the first long-haired werewolf I'd ever seen? No, technically, I guess Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea had the first kind of longer hair.
Yeah, I remembered seeing some long-haired werewolves.
Those two
at that point.
Yeah. And the sign said, long-haired hippie werewolf need not apply. But the thing is, you look at the performance of Kerwin Matthews reminds me of the monsters, the werewolves that they had. They had a two episodes of werewolves on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea.
Yeah, yeah.
Where the werewolf just isn't skulking and stalking like a, you know, you put a little bit of a wolf into a man.
Yeah,
you would be very stealth-like. People are going to miss this because Jim can see me on camera, but the rest of you will not. But there's this sort of seizure-y thing that these werewolves do to prove that they're so freaking evil that they're just standing there, they're just jittering with their rage. And it's like, calm down a bit.
Right.
I don't know.
And that's what I talk about when I say scenery chewing and a little over the top. And
yeah,
and it was, what I've really appreciated about movies that involve lycanthropy, that I'll say that instead of werewolf, is that they're understated. I mean, you know, what Lon Chaney Jr. did was a very understated approach. Even the guy, and I can't think of the actor's name who played him in the movie, The Werewolf, which is still one of my favorite movies about the subject. He was very understated, but unfortunately Kerwin in this one, and I think he was directed this way, so I put some of the blame on Nathan Jurin a little bit on this. He was just way over the top when he was in the makeup. I mean,
it was bad.
Yeah. It was like, God, Kerwin.
I mean, you know, go out and
someone trying to audition to be a werewolf. And this is, you know, what you might've gotten, you know, it was like a little bit too much.
Yeah. I almost felt like, with me, anytime I start a project that I'm working on, there's always research.
Sure.
Yeah. And in this case, I think maybe he should have studied some wildlife. But I know it's easier now because you turn on the TV, so you can go to Animal Planet and watch hour after hour of animals doing stuff. But there, it was a seizure-y, kind of graceless werewolf.
Yeah.
Still better than the werewolf off of the Night Stalker episode.
Oh, yes.
My vote is worst werewolf of all time.
I have to agree with you on that. Yes.
And I've actually kind of grown fond of the werewolves on Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, even though they're sort of seizure-y too.
Yeah.
But this was good makeup
with
a good actor who wasn't doing his job right, or maybe they just didn't give a crap. Maybe they both knew it. I don't know.
I just don't think he was given a chance to do much with it. Because he's good. He's good in the scene as a father, you know, when he's human. And I'll get into the kid in a minute because that's a whole different story.
Yeah.
But I think he did. He was very effective as that. Here's this guy. And if you're not familiar with the movie, again, we're going to spoil everything. We always do. He's in the middle of a divorce. You know, he's been divorced. He's got this kid who's, I would say, you know, almost teenage. I don't know, maybe 11, 12 years old, something like that. You know, he and the wife just, they saw life from two different angles, and that broke up their marriage. Although there's still some love there, you can tell it's just one of those things that they just can't live with one another, basically. So that,
right.
And the kid's caught in the middle of that, hoping they'll all get back together. I mean, it's a typical sitcom stuff that we saw in the early 70s, because it seemed like every sitcom that came out was about a divorced family. So, you know, during this time, it seemed like every sitcom that was on TV involved a single parent, whether it was a divorce or whatever. So this is something that was sort of, when I talked about in the beginning, sort of the cliches that you're going to see in this movie. But I think Kerwin Matthews does, I think he does pretty well establishing this the father who is trying to maintain a good relationship with his son.
Yes.
You know, in the middle of this divorce, knowing that it's the marriage is hopeless, you know, that he pretty much makes it, you know, pretty apparent that they're not going to get back together, but they're cordial with one another.
Yeah, sure.
You know, in all of that. And he has a pretty liberal visitation type situation where he takes his kid up into the mountains to this cabin he's got up there where all the fun stuff happens. But so, I mean, I think that element of his character is done pretty well.
Right.
You know, but then when he gets into the wolf makeup, it's, you know, Katie bar the door. It's just way over the top, you know.
Katie bar the door.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, I feel like I'm sad. It makes me sad when I watch this movie.
No, it's sort of, we're all fans of Kerwin Matthews. I mean, you know.
Yeah, I thought he was a clean cut. I mean, there was a story that I was working on, a Ray Harryhausen book where it was articles from, it was, it was initials. What's the name of that book? I feel bad about not remembering it, but it's a very famous, very well-researched Ray Harryhausen series. I think it was either of magazines that got put into book form or a series of books. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's a story about Kerwin Matthews on the set of a soap opera where William Self, who was Bill Self.
Yeah, Bill Self.
And you know,
Batman.
Batman. But before that, he was the one that shoots James Arness in the thing.
Yep.
You know, shoots him first. Anyway, that guy. So Mark Hamill is new to the set of this soap opera, and in walks Kerwin Matthews, and Mark Hamill loses his mind. He's like, oh my God, Kerwin Matthews. Because he's a Ray Harryhausen fanatic. Right, Matter of fact, Mark Hamill wrote articles for that magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
Back before he was Luke Skywalker, maybe when he was Luke Skywalker, I don't know, but he starts talking with Kerwin, and Kerwin's all excited that somebody, you know, wants to talk about him, and he loved the Sinbad and all that. And Bill Self comes in and starts yelling at Mark Hamill, who's new to the set. He goes, quit slowing down production kind of stuff. And Mark Hamill turns to him and goes, oh my God, you're William Self from the thing. and then William Self, who's known as being like kind of a, you know, yelling at people, goes, oh, okay, well just hurry it up and get back to work.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So it was a story like that. But, you know, you look at Kerwin Matthews, I'm like, we'd kill to meet Kerwin Matthews.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Man. Yeah.
I feel for him, but then, and I don't know his state of mind. He ended up becoming an antiques dealer later.
Yeah, he had a very successful shop. Yeah,
maybe he was fine. Maybe he didn't care, or maybe he did care, or maybe who knows.
He has in interviews never made any apologies for his career. He said he had always hoped that he could have found that one role, that one really terrific role that everyone remembers him for. This movie was not it. He said he had a lot of fun doing the Sinbad stuff and the action adventure stuff that he did. And he said, you know, hey, you know, he always wanted to have three films in the can every year to make sure that he was going to be able to survive.
Yeah.
He said he makes no, you know, he was like with John Agar. John Agar sort of had the same attitude. He made no apologies for the work he did in films. He had a lot of fun doing it. He made a living at it and loved the fact that people enjoyed what he did. But yeah, he didn't accomplish what he might have wanted to accomplish, but he still was satisfied with the way he was.
You know, you can't climb in somebody's head and tell them they're unhappy. You know, if somebody, you know, it's like when you, the thing of people in India walking across hot coals or sitting on a bed of nails or whatever. it's like if inside their head, they're saying that they're happy and they genuinely believe it. And that's the thing about this. I mean, maybe he was totally fine with doing, okay, we're making a werewolf movie. I'm not taking it very seriously. Okay. And then you collect a paycheck.
From everything I've read about him, he loved the work. I mean, he
was very good. Being an actor. This is the one film that I kind of go, wow. But I think it was almost like, kind of like, okay, I'm out of here anyway. I'm wondering. Yeah. But you look at Sinbad, I love his performance in Sinbad. I love his sword fighting because he looks like a guy who's actually doing work.
Yeah.
When he picks up that sword and he's hacking at stuff, it's not a dance or anything with him. It's like, I got to chop through this problem, whether he's fighting a skeleton or whatever the heck he's going for. And he's excellent in it. And he was really good in those Hammer films. I enjoyed his performance, and there is one of the best things about those films.
Absolutely.
His favorite, I think, that he said he ever did was a two-part episode. I don't remember what composer it was.
Johann Strauss.
Strauss for the Wonderful World of Disney.
The Waltz King was the name of the
And he said that was his favorite thing that he ever did.
He loved that.
He was very good in Gulliver. He was very, very good in that. That was a Harryhausen film that isn't completely like what you consider a Harryhausen film, because most of the special effects were him being gigantic and stuff. But still very, very good, very likable. Now we talked about Robert Wilkie. We talked about George Gaines. I think, although I don't know much about Elaine Devery, I think I'm saying that right.
Yeah, she's not.
I think she was fine. I mean, she was.
Fine. And again, she's another one that probably wished she had done more. But the biggest thing a lot of people remember her for is that she was married to Mickey Rooney for a few years, and that was her second. She was divorced. She had a bad marriage. Her first marriage ended. Right. Badly. She was married to a big athlete. He became a drunk, very abusive. She got out of that marriage, and then she married Mickey Rooney. And there were pluses and minuses to that one. She was asked about her marriage to Mickey Rooney and said, "Well, I guess the other six wives, you know, didn't get it wrong or something." You know, that's sort of like it was a sort of a rough time. She was only married to him for about like 6 or 7 years, but you know, she. She's got nearly 50 credits, you know, on her resume.
She acted
right up until 1999. She's still with us. I mean, she's still alive. She's 92 years old.
Well, she was good. I mean, I thought she did fine. You know, as handsome as Kerwin Matthews is, she was as beautiful. And I think that was one of those typical California looking kind of couples in a movie.
It's like middle-aged people are our stars here. I mean, like she's in her 40s. He was in his 40s, like that, which was sort of unusual for movies.
You start to
like
lose
that.
Me. Movies nowadays lose me and stuff where the people look like they are too young to be in the middle of what they're doing.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Like,
exactly.
Oh, here he comes. Oh, he's a surgeon.
Yeah.
The guy looks like he's 25 years old.
Looks like Doogie Howser, you know.
have you ever seen real brain surgeons? I have.
Yeah,
they
went to school with one.
They've got the weight of the world on their shoulders. They're usually prematurely aged because of the crap that they have to do, you know, and I'm not a big fan. That's one of the things about modern film. It's like, well, we got to get them younger.
Yeah, they got
to
get
right
younger,
up to the
younger.
Point where you can believe it. And it's like, to me, I always, even as a little kid, I preferred watching. I'm not talking about necessarily what, you know, great grandpa was doing or something, but I mean, on shows where the people were in their 40s and 50s, those people had lived. I could believe the situation.
Well, and again, she did a lot of modeling in the 50s. So she's 20 years removed from when she did a lot of her modeling work and stuff. Still very attractive.
Oh, yeah. She's a lovely woman. Yeah. And she did a good job.
She does a really good job with this one. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I know you want to talk about Little Richie.
Little Richie. Oh my God. Scott Seeley. Look, hey, Scott, you know, if you listen to the show, I'm not ragging you or anything.
Love you.
But it's like, acting was probably not your first choice as a career. He basically has, you know, the two things he's remembered for is this movie, this is going to be like the highlight of his career. And he had a couple of appearances on Emergency, the TV show Emergency.
Yeah.
He was like the token kid that would show up in all those cop shows and stuff back then. They always had one. And a lot of it was probably, I want to say, I don't want to dump it all on Nathan Jurin, but I think a lot of it was just like the way he was. Somebody said, hey, well, this is what kids do in movies in the 70s. So this is what you're going to have him do.
Well,
he's an irritating character.
Well, you know, it's funny because at first he's really irritating. Then he kind of lessens up a little bit. I mean, for a little bit, for about 20 minutes or so of the film, I'm like, okay, the kids.
Yeah, midway through the movie. Yeah.
I got sick and tired of my dad fought off the werewolf and whack and whack.
Yeah.
And went, shut up.
All the characters in the movie were saying too.
Well, like, but after a while, it's like, you know, but it's like, or this, I'm trying to get this voice just right, but it's my dad. I mean, you know, I can only take so much of that crap, and he did it over and over again.
Yeah.
I don't think the kid was necessarily a bad actor. I think that the lines and the repeating.
Oh, no, I think, no, again, that's why I'm saying, Scott, I'm not really ragging on you. I think some of that was the way you were directing.
I don't think the kid, and I think the kid, you know, it's like when you watch people that direct children 99% of the time. I mean, especially back in the 60s. Now, they've gotten better at 60s and 70s and stuff. It was all like, oh, God, they got a kid in this episode or they got a kid in this movie. But then you look at somebody like Spielberg who can direct children.
He knows how to. Yeah,
he knows how to direct everybody. Absolutely. He gets the best performances out of everybody. And he does it with the kids, the Poltergeist, E.T., whatever.
Yep.
You look at that and it's like, see, you can get children to act. Now, I think of actors, you know, from the 60s that were good. Kurt Russell.
Yep.
Billy Mumy, kids that were comfortable in front of the camera. They That's looked, right. And there were other ones. There were other really good kids.
But Paul Peterson was legendary, and he worked with kids later on.
You look at that kind of group, and then you see this kind of thing, and you go, now I know. Who knows? How many days did they film this in? What kind of production budget did they actually have? What was the rules for making this film? Were they pigeonholed into you know, like were they like forced to do something in such an amount of time and go,
look, I think a lot of this
is almost like meatball surgery.
I think this was shot like a made for TV film. So they were probably on that kind of rushed schedule with a lower budget. And I really think that had a big factor in this, because that's why this film feels the way it feels.
Well, you look at this movie. With I mean, I'll say this, the, you know, they filmed in a nice location. That's easy enough, though.
Beautiful
in California. I swear to God, all I kept on thinking was, you know, Steve Austin versus Bigfoot. I've said that before and I'll say it again, because or a little bit like The Prophecy, the one with the radioactive bear.
Oh, I love that movie. Yes.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
As people know, I did a show on it a few months ago. Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. And stuff like that. But the negatives in it hurt it. Now,
yeah,
I'm going to go back to the beginning of the film.
Okay.
A guy and his dad are driving it. It's getting dusk. It's always dusk. Mm-hmm. There. And all of a sudden, just no pomp, no circumstance, no buildup, no music, no nothing. And it's just a werewolf there.
Okay. He just happened to be cruising around. He's cruising around the woods there looking for something. Yeah.
It worked for me at the beginning of the Jack Nicholson movie, Wolf, where he hits one with a car and then gets out. It does not work in this movie. It's like, boy, dad, car, driving. Oh, look, up on the hill, a werewolf. No buildup. When the werewolf shows up, he just sort of shows up. When Kerwin Matthews...
Oh, yeah, we don't know anything about how that came about. Yeah.
Well, and by the way, that guy is, you saw him a lot.
He's a stuntman.
Star Trek. I remember specifically him in the fight with
Paul Baxley,
He was a good, that's one of those, some of those old cowboy stuntmen that, you know, guys would take a fall and do stuff.
Absolutely.
Holy crap.
He did like 150 different films and TV shows.
He was great.
As a stuntman. And then he would do, you know, extra acting like he did in this one, where he gets to play a werewolf and attack somebody.
Yeah. But, you know, the actual performance by the werewolf and the presentation of the werewolf had no mystery to it, had no romance, right, had no passion to it. Nowadays, movies are almost so ridiculously over the top of the buildup before a monster shows up. It's, you know, all the music and the subtleties and you see a hand first and then you see it. And when it finally, it's a shame because they could have easily done it with this film, given how good the Tom Berman makeup is. Now, we talked about liking it. I want to go to a couple of specifics about the makeup. One is the white hair. The other thing is, this is, if it's not the first, it's one of the very first times you ever see a muzzle on a werewolf makeup.
Right.
It's a little different. It's expanded out. It's probably a little bit more Planet of the Apes now has muzzles and they did a few things on Lost in Space and stuff, which by the way were experiments for the Planet of the Apes makeup.
Right.
There's and so now you've got this guy who built a muzzle on the werewolf, and it's almost like this is almost the lily pads in the pond that the Frogleys do to get all the way up to American Werewolf in London.
I was thinking and the Howling, those two, because that you wouldn't see it again until those two movies.
Yes, and so I think that this is a little bit of a bridge of that, and also, like I said, it's a early 1970s movie. There's a bunch of hippies in here. The dad's
That's my next point is talking about cliches.
These were almost to the point where it's like, boy.
Those of us who lived through the early 70s, there was this major spiritual revival that happened, you know, from about 1971 on for a few years. And we got a lot of this showing up in movies like Vanishing Point. You had the religious people that were with the snake handlers, Billy Jack. In fact, one of Billy Jack's supporting actors was in this movie. The gal that played Cindy played the girlfriend of the Jesus freak who actually wrote the film.
Wait a minute. You mean to tell me that the guy that plays the leader of the freak wrote the film?
That's Bob Hummel. Yeah.
I didn't like him. I didn't like him already. Now you're kind of.
He was an actor, did a lot of extra work, featured extra work and stuff, but he's got a writing credit, and that one writing credit is The Boy Who Cried Werewolf. So he...
It's gone.
That was Bob Hummel calling.
I'm going to kill you.
So he wrote the part for himself and played the part.
The whole thing.
This is again another one of those over the top, but it was so cliche. The whole religious commune thing was so cliched from so many movies around this time.
Well, also too, I mean, you sort of look at the way things are altered. I get a bit of a, not from them, not from those characters strictly, but you look at the werewolf, you look at the long hair, you look at the hippies, all that kind of stuff, and we're still kind of. They're still in the shadow of the Charles Manson sort of thing.
Oh yeah, no, that also has an influence on a lot of film streams.
Yeah, the cult. Now he did have a couple of really good lines, which I was like, okay, I kind of dig this guy. And that was like, oh, Jesus will do this, and Jesus,
yeah,
and heaven and hell, and we can see sin coming from a mile, and blah blah blah. He'd say all that stuff, but then after the guy, he actually thinks he's performing an exorcism to get the werewolf, but it's actually just the sun coming up. And then his girlfriend turns to him and says something like, oh, you did wonderful on kind of stuff. He goes, to heck with that. I'm going to go tell somebody. In other words, he was sort of, you knew that even he knew he was full of BS with the yelling and the screaming, but every once in a while he'd make a decision.
He'd surprise himself.
Okay. He's
a little bit
honest. He's ultimately honest as to that something's really messed up here. The girl that called her lover boy or called him.
That's Susan Foster, by the way. She played Cindy in Billy Jack. So
yeah, and she the whole, it looked like everybody in that film in that commune came from Billy Jack.
But I think there were a lot of Billy Jack people that probably were playing extras in this film, because it sure reminded me of that film.
Yeah.
And again, folks, I loved Billy Jack as a kid. That was one of my favorite films.
Oh, me too. Yeah,
films.
It was cool. It was different. Yeah, you've got, but I love the fact that the sheriff, you know, comes yeah. back and, you know, with that gravelly voice of his, Robert Wilkie.
Right.
And he's like, you kid, you better stop what you're doing here. And, you know, and it's like, you know, he could tell he just hated the Jesus
yeah.
freaks and all that. And they'd just be yelling more stuff at him and right. all that. But I was like, I was kind of rooting for Wilkie. I was like, go on, Sheriff, throw him out. I would have.
Plus, they were driving a Dodge van. That's cliched in itself. These things were like all over the place. And they were like, every movie you saw hippies in drove Dodge vans.
And VWs, and all, which they also had.
Oh, and I love the VWs. Now, this I loved that about this movie. It was all yeah. of them. They had a 66 VW Bug in there. It was my very first car that I ever bought in my life. And I wish I still had that car. I loved that car.
Oh, my God.
But, I mean, yeah, the Dodge van all painted up with, you know, the sun is rising and, you know, God is love and love is all you need. And, you sure. know, all the slogans and stuff over it. So, I mean, it's just like, it's just cliched city. Even in 73, when I watched this movie, I'm like, okay, guys, come on. Really? Come on.
Yeah.
I've seen this before in every independent film ever made during this time.
Back to, since we're, now that we're done talking about things we don't like about the film, let's go back and talk about things we don't like about the film. And that is later when the dad has been bit by the werewolf. The first werewolf dies. He falls on a spike or something like that.
Yeah.
And now when the werewolf shows up, it's exactly the same thing. There's no buildup. Like Richie's running through the woods,
right,
chasing for his father, who he knows is a werewolf. All the cops are behind him and mom and everything.
Yeah.
And he runs in and all of a sudden the werewolf is just sort of there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all this buildup of the kid running through, but then all of a sudden the werewolf is just sort of like matter of fact.
Hello.
Yeah, it could be back then that was enough. You know, The Exorcist, you know, to go to that film, that is 73 or Exorcist 72.
Yeah, 70. No, 73.
Okay, so 73 has such a perfect buildup when things start to go bad. Yes. Just there's little weirdnesses and little creepinesses and the sound effects. Of course, you talk about a movie with millions of dollars of a budget as opposed to this other thing, but still, editing would have handled a lot of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The other thing, the day for night, and then one giant flood lamp someplace.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's supposed to be at nighttime, but the werewolf is lit up and the light, and this is, you know, one thing I'm kind of an expert on is light temperatures and stuff because of all the painting. I mean, in a photography and stuff I've done, you've got this warmly lit up werewolf in the middle of the night running around. Just happened to be convenient that somebody.
Oh, it's a full moon, so maybe that's your spotlight there.
Right? Yeah, because the moon is so orange looking. You know, it's just one of those where you sort of look at it and you just,
I know, yeah.
Just some bounce light, do something. You
well,
know?
And I had some problems. You know, there's a lot of humanity. There's more humanity to this werewolf than any other werewolf I've seen in a movie. I mean, usually the thing that has always attracted to me, you know, from the time I was a little kid watching the very first werewolf movie I ever saw, was the cursed aspect of it, because you'd be human and you're struggling with the fact that when it's a full moon and you convert, you cannot stop what you're doing. You're like pure evil animal and you're just out there to kill. I mean, Lon Chaney probably was one of the best actors at it and showing us that tortured thing. David Naughton did a great job in American Werewolf in London.
Very
same
good.
Way.
Very good.
You know, like that, but I saw none of that here. When he's around the kid and when he gets around the wife, it's all of a sudden, I'm not going to hurt them. I'm not going to, you know, because they're, you know.
Oh, that's another.
See what I'm saying? You know,
that's another complaint I've got.
Yeah.
The werewolf. Now, I know they've had a werewolf or two that could talk in movies. I always hated that. Yeah. And I hated that Bela Lugosi movie where he had the talking assistant werewolf.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you liked it because I think you did give it a pretty good review. But I mean, to me, it's one of those where
why does
a werewolf have to talk? Oh, should I get your bags for you? Get them out to the car, sir. You know, like yeah, okay, get it, Wolfie. But in this movie,
that was meant to be a comic character, and you knew it.
But the werewolf in this one, he doesn't kill certain people.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, he
makes these choices that he's not supposed to make.
Yeah, he's there. He's I mean, he goes inside. He's got a bag and he dumps it in a hole and uses a shovel to bury him. Like, wait a minute, what's this? I mean, this is more like Mr. Hyde if that's the case.
Yeah,
like Mr. Hyde is evil and does evil things, but is intelligent, werewolves are supposed to be very primal. And I don't like that's that.
That's the part that bugged me the most about this film.
Yeah. And there's that. And then he doesn't kill the wife. He starts looking at her like some stalking pervert when she's asleep in the chair.
Yeah. And then he just picks her up and carries her off. How cliched is that? It's like, yeah, okay, look, the creature can do that with Julie Adams, and I buy it. The sure. werewolf cannot do that with this woman.
In a way, that's one of those things where if you go with old werewolf movies and stuff, the werewolf actually instinctually seeks and kills those he loves.
That's right.
Now, maybe this werewolf wasn't that kind of werewolf, but still, the fact that he surgically treats them with kid gloves when he's killing everybody. Let's talk about another
We've got a great scene when the kid first discovers his father's a werewolf.
Yeah.
Where he just goes on a rampage and kills all these people. The guy in the car and tears the head off of the TV repairman. Really and his, yeah. No, but I mean, we sort of figure it out. I mean, it's all implied, but it's like, you know, and then, you know.
Yeah, I thought that scene was horrible. I mean, it's like, it's more like he's causing traffic accidents than actually being a werewolf. He doesn't leap. Oh,
he was definitely doing that. Yeah,
he's out there with this little seizure.
In a remote mountain road. A lot of traffic that night.
Yeah, all of a sudden, it's just oh my god, the concert let out. You know, and so he's standing in the middle of the street with the car lights hitting on him, with his hands doing the seizure. Right. Only Jim can see this at home. People, sorry. But he's like, and then they're like, oh my God. So, you know, you're driving down the road, somebody's there's a werewolf in the middle of the road. What's the first thing you're going to think? It's an idiot in a mask.
Yes.
You know, it's some.
Is it Halloween? Oh my God.
Yeah, or something. And then they just drive around him while the werewolf goes, hey, wait, come back. I want to kill you.
Yeah.
And then he wrecked one car, goes over a cliff, right. And then the van goes and hits the tree.
But this is all in one night. This happens
all in one night, and the kid's standing there watching it. But it's just the whole thing that the monster really isn't doing anything other than standing there and scaring people.
Yeah,
none of the actual car wrecks or that leave these people vulnerable to attack. Right. are because he leapt into the open window of the vehicle and killed them, and then the car crashed. And
would have liked.
Yeah, that but this was just sort of
great.
The van hits the tree, and the hippie repairman's hanging halfway out, right. And then the werewolf, and it's like, yeah, brother. I mean, Jim and I talked about this, folks, before we started this episode.
Yeah.
And it was, the question was thrown up, which, you know, it happens every once in a while. Is this movie Ragorama material?
Yeah.
And the thing is, no, this is actually not at that level to where it's so wacky, crazy bad that you can just sit there and just have one joke after the other.
Right.
This is a little more depressing.
It is.
It's a little more depressing.
There's a lot of potential here, you know,
I would have just, if I was a director, I mean, it's like, come on, go out on an upswing. Go, hey, look, Kerwin, quit with the typewriter fingers.
Right.
You know, quit with the thing, you know, and, you know, go over to the zoo next weekend or to tomorrow, and I'll give you a ticket and go look at the walls.
I think Nathan must have been influenced by the Aurora model, because the very first model kit I ever built, the monster model kit, was the Wolfman. And, you know, he's there.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And you can't see this, folks, but Mark knows what I'm talking about. Everyone who's seen the Wolfman model kit for Aurora knows what I'm talking about. The hands up in the air going, ah.
I'll tell you this. If any person's listened to this podcast has not seen the Aurora model kit, just turn off the show right now.
Yeah.
Just go away. I mean, really, I don't think there's anything.
I'm not sure about that. Go Google it and check it out. You'll see.
Yeah.
Or go to Classic Movie Monsters, because we've got a guy that has built virtually every model known to man. It posts every day, you know, different scenarios and stuff.
So, yeah, we felt that it's one of those weird limbo sort of movies that it's got some good points. Once again, mm-hmm. you know, we love the makeup. We love some of the actors and stuff, the locations. It's got so much going against it at the same time. Now, I'm not telling anybody not to watch this movie.
I wouldn't either. I think it's,
I don't think there's been a film we've ever reviewed. I mean, even Creeping Terror, I think at least everybody should see it once. It's like, you know, see Paris and die. see creeping terror and wish you were dead. But it's one of those where almost every film that we've ever talked about, I've never said, don't watch it. Just don't watch it.
Oh, we'll leave it up to you. Yeah. We leave it up to the audience.
Well, I know that Shout Factory's got a copy of this, I think on Blu-ray, pretty sure.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And at least if you're like a werewolf fan, especially of makeup and stuff, one thing I really like about the makeup too, is he actually had the little dog lips, the little black lips
yeah.
that dogs have.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, ultimately I think I'm about done. I think we're finished. I
do want to say that, you know, and again, if we encapsulate this, it like you were saying, and one thing, it's just disappointment, because I go back to, there's one scene in this, and I think we've already touched on it, where George Gaines plays he's playing a therapist who's treating the kid, because the kid is struggling with this divorce of his parents. And so this is one of the things that supposedly sets up why no one believes this whole werewolf thing, in addition to the fact that nobody believes in werewolves in this movie, but just because this kid tends to exaggerate and see things that aren't there and all that, you know, there's a whole lot that could have been done here. But his death scene, George Gaines's character's death scene, when they find him, is a really, really good scene as far as.
Yeah, that was
spooky and creepy and horrible.
It's really almost like a still image, other than he's laying there. He's laying
and it,
there,
and it just stands out among this whole thing. And it's like, why couldn't you do more of that?
Yeah, that probably is the best moment in the whole film.
It really is. Yeah,
and it was not. It was understated.
Yes.
It was well done. And it's funny too, because like I said, I haven't seen this since the early 70s, mm-hmm. but I remember Kerwin Matthews was in the office talking to him.
Right.
And I'm like, wait a minute. I think I remember what happens. And then when it showed up again, it was almost like, visiting an old friend, dead psychiatrist laying on the floor covered in blood.
Yeah.
I mean, it was kind of cool to see that. And it was, I agree with you. I think I'd say we both say that's probably the highlight of the film.
I think it is. Yeah. It really was.
Now there's another scene another moment in the film I did like, is when the sheriff Wilkie, when they're down there in the cellar, and they said, we're going to get a posse together. I'd like you to come with us. And he goes, well, we got to get back into town. And he goes, we got a maniac running around loose, and you're sorry. And then he just turns around. That is Wilkie playing a Wilkie type. Yeah. I mean,
typical. So, yeah.
I love that, because it's like, he really doesn't give anybody any quarter. I mean, he doesn't.
That's right.
He doesn't let anybody off the hook. You know, I love that one. What's up here? Is there? And he goes, and then Wilkie goes, God. Yeah. just to shut the guy up, you know. It's pretty.
I've got to mention one more thing, and folks, if you have not seen this movie, this is a major ultimate spoiler. Put us on pause right now, and don't listen to the rest of this podcast until you've seen the movie, because it is the very end of the film, and it's a major hook at the end of the film. So I'm just going to stop it there, give you a chance to put it in pause. When they finally confront the werewolf at the end, this is the father, you know, this is Kerwin Matthews as werewolf.
Yeah.
The posse is finding him. They're blowing him away with the guns. Of course,
they shoot him a lot.
But the bullets don't affect him, because a bullet, as we all know, will not kill a werewolf unless it's a silver bullet or whatever. But this forces him to fall backwards on a board that has busted up, because the cross that the Jesus freaks had, the guy had backed into it and knocked it over. So you've got this perfectly placed stake conveniently right there where the werewolf can fall on it, and it pierces his heart and kills him, sort of like the wolf that attacked him. That's, you know, he was pierced and killed too. And you've got Wilkie as the sheriff looking at this guy transform back to the father. He gets this sheepish look on his face and goes over to the kid and brushes his head, sort of like, oh, geez, you were right all along, and walks off.
You're a fine young man.
It was like, I was, yeah. And it's like, oh, no, don't do that. Plus, when Werewolf had his son, because he not only carried off his ex-wife at one point and then dropped her, he carries off his son, and they all confront him and they say, no, don't shoot him because you might hit the kid. And of course, one guy would say, no, hit the kid. We don't care. But he bites down on the kid's arm. And then they finally break him loose. You know what's coming. I mean, it's like the end of the movie shows the mother looking at the wound on the kid's arm. It happens to be the same arm that the father was bit on by the other werewolf. And you're thinking, okay, are they going to put the little question mark on the end? At least they didn't do that. But it's like, somebody actually thought that there might be a sequel potential for this movie, I guess. Because it's like, when I saw that, it's like, oh, don't go there, please. Don't.
Well, I thought I was done, but you reinvigorated me too.
Yes, I know.
To well, talk I mean, about that's, the ending of this film. So if you're.
Yeah, that
you're,
the ending really disturbed me. Yeah,
so. The werewolf is running with the boy. I've almost wondered once or twice if there was a stuntman doing it, because there's a couple of times he picked the kid up and slung him that I thought maybe that's a stuntman in the makeup, but maybe not. Who knows? You've got the dad there. All these cops show up, and the hippies and the good old boys that are back in the back with the shotguns and rifles, the posse. And they start shooting him. Now, this is a PG-rated film, so it definitely isn't Sonny Corleone getting mowed down at the toll booth. You know what I mean?
No.
But really, as much as they shot him, you could have filmed it that way. I mean, you literally could have shown. Because they did show little holes in his chest, the bullet holes through the shirt and everything like that. So the bullets were puncturing the werewolf. But, I mean, they were pumping him full of lead. Yeah. And then he turns around and falls on the stake of the cross. And everybody's standing there where it turns back to Kerwin Matthews. And like you said, when the sheriff goes over and rubs the top of the kid's head, it's like, that's his father laying there dead. And the kid has been trying to tell you. And you just like, well, Skippy.
Yep, I guess you're right.
Time to head back to the office. And he smiles at the kid. It's be like, what would you do if you were the sheriff? You just killed the werewolf and it turns back into the kid's dad. You'd be like, son, I am so sorry.
Yeah.
I mean, you were right.
That's what you would expect. Yeah.
But the question is, what else could they have done with him? And they needed to mow him down.
Yeah.
He needed to die. Even Kerwin Matthews. I mean, you could tell that he knew in the daytime that he was probably responsible.
Oh, he knew there was no way out of this.
Or that he was responsible still. I mean, you know, in the waking thing. So, you know, I mean, I was rooting for the cops.
Yeah.
I was just to stop those seizure-y hands. The werewolf. I mean, it looked like some demented piano player, you know.
Yes.
That, something. Sorry.
I just know that the guy that was the posed for the Aurora model kit, you know, was probably saying, stop it. That's not how it's supposed to be done.
Well, the other thing too about that Aurora model kit is the werewolf in those movies never had a shirt off. They had the money to do it on the model kit.
That's
where
true.
He was like, you know, furry from the waist up.
Right, right.
I don't want to think about the rest of it. But so I don't know. I mean, in the case of this movie, I'm not telling anybody not to watch it.
No,
it's sort of like, it's a product of its age. At the time, I loved it. I needed those kind of films. I was happy to go see them. I'd leave the theater going, yes, I enjoyed it. And
you could go see it for like a buck. I mean, you know, movies.
No,
like
in this case, I think it was where I was. I think it was at the airbase. You could see it for a quarter.
Yeah.
I
saw it at a multiplex, but it was on one of the, you know, off screens of the multiplex. It was like a buck and a half, something like that. You know,
I mean, it was fine. I mean, we wanted to see some monsters run. I mean, back at the time that we weren't nearly as critical of this film. I mean, oh good, there's a werewolf. Oh, there's running around. Oh, they're shooting at him. I mean, all that stuff was fine.
Yeah.
But now I think that you go back and you look at stuff like, you know, the original Wolfman movie with all of that agony anguish and everything. And it just makes the Wolfman look so much better. I mean,
absolutely.
The Oliver Reed movie.
Even the werewolf movie from 1957, you know,
we talked about.
I mean, it just really elevates those.
The one thing about the werewolf is that they really used their scenery as opposed to this movie. You just, like I said, once again,
but also I like the kid in you got the same situation, the kid whose father is a werewolf and he doesn't really understand it. And, you know, and it's played so much better, so much better.
Yeah. I mean, Werewolf of London, you look at all the movies back then and you just, they got them so right, you would have thought that by the time we got to 1973, it'd be, I don't know, there was something about it. There was something about the movie that seemed like it was directed by a non-monster movie person. Maybe that's what it was.
Yeah, that could have been it.
But if you take the job, you know, if you take the job, do the job.
That's right.
So
anyway, folks, The Boy Who Cried Werewolf.
So it's kind of weird because normally I cherry pick what Jim and I are doing. But for some reason this time, just because I hadn't seen the film in so many years, I decided I was going to watch it and do the show with Jim. And boy, was I sorry.
Yeah.
No, it was just sort of like sometimes we cherry pick what, oh yeah, I definitely want to do that film. And it's always something really cool. And this time I said, let's just jump in. Let's just jump in with both feet.
To
this cinematic masterpiece, double bill with Citizen Kane, you know?
That's right. Yeah. All right, folks, there you have it. Well, we're doing a lot of films from this time period because I'm looking for 50th anniversary films that either we've talked about or haven't talked about. And there's still a lot out there.
Yeah.
From this time period that are just a lot of fun to talk about. So you never know what's coming up next. Mark, great having you again. I'm glad our schedules are starting to get to where we can start doing this again quite a bit.
We're busy people, both of us.
It's been a crazy year. So folks, thanks for your support. You're doing well by us. Have a great week, and we will see you next Monday.
Helm, report.
Sir, there's Klingons on the starboard bow.
Starboard bow?
Starboard bow!
What are they doing there?
They seem to be waiting for the new episode of Earth Station Trek.
Science, what do we know about this Earth Station Trek?
It's a podcast that treks through the history of Star Trek, from the early days on NBC to the future on Paramount Plus and everywhere in between.
Navigation, how would one find such a podcast?
By setting coordinates for earthstationtrek.com or by doing a sensor sweep of Spotify, iTunes, or any other quadrant where fine podcasts are available.
Captain, what are we going to do about the Klingons?
We come in peace, Commander. Weapon station, shoot to kill.
Shoot to kill!
Shoot to kill!
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.